Welcome to Jaipur Bites, the JLF podcast. I'm your host, Laksh Datta. This episode is a live session from day 4 of Jaipur Lit Fest 2023, and it's called Russia, Revolution and Civil War. Anthony Beevor and Luke Harding in conversation with Simon Sebag Montefiore. There
Ladies and gentlemen, it's wonderful to be back here on the main stage in Jaipur. Thanks for joining us. And we've got a pretty fascinating session for you today. Our mothership is going to be Anthony Beevor's masterful new book, Russia, Revolution and Civil War. But we also have Luke Harding here, who's been reporting from Ukraine. Who's a historian of now, we can say, who's covered the degradation of the Russian state in the 21st century. And I've written the Romanovs about the creation of the Russian Empire in the 18th and 19th centuries. So we are going to cover the whole Russian Civil War, which was one of the most significant events that formed the 20th century and the events of the 21st century. Over 10 million people died in this terrible conflict. And I'm going to go straight to Anthony. And to start with, Anthony, why did you choose this subject? You've done Stalingrad, you've done Berlin, both astonishing world bestsellers. Why did you choose to do the Russian Civil War, and why now?
Well, originally, I wanted to do it 30 years ago. Fortunately, my publishers at the time said, "You're crazy," and they were quite right. A, the Russian archives were not open at that time. And B, as a historian, I simply wasn't ready for it. I didn't have the experience. So I'm very grateful they stopped me. The reason why it was so important, of course, was that I think all historians who've written about the First World War and describe it as the original catastrophe of the 20th century are absolutely right. The reason why the Russian Civil War was so important was because of its influence afterwards. The horrors, the destruction, the vicious circle of fear that it created across Europe and the world produced, A, the split between left and right, between red and white, between fascism and communism. But it produced, as I say, this circle of fear, which led to the Spanish Civil War and then on to the Second World War. So this is why it was such an influential conflict.
And I think it also created the brutalization of the Soviet state, which has had such implications today, which brings me to Ukraine. The war was fought on many, many fronts, as Anthony will tell us soon, and we're not only going to dwell in Ukraine, because we have a session tonight, me and Luke, which we will be talking only about Ukraine. So we're going to be talking today about Georgia, about the Baltics, about the Mongolian front. But, of course, the great battlefield of the Russian Civil War was Ukraine. And, Luke, tell us, you know, what is the feeling today, the beginning of the Russian invasion of Ukraine, the link with that civil war?
Actually, I was in Kiev on February the 23rd of last year, 2022, just hours before the full-scale Russian invasion, having dinner with a wonderful Ukrainian novelist called Andrei Kurkov. And it did actually feel like a sort of moment freighted with history, because Kurkov at that point was working on a novel set in the Civil War, set in the sort of tumultuous period after 1917, and he was showing around the dinner table, along with, we were eating Ukrainian soup, drinking honey vodka, and he'd been given secret police files from the Bolsheviks, who, when they swept into Kiev, began rounding up various people, the bourgeoisie, white officers, and so on. It was hard not to feel, actually, we're talking about February of last year, that a century after those events that Anthony writes about so brilliantly and so well, history was repeating. In other words, with a kind of Moscow army at the gates coming to crush Ukrainian independence. I mean, the Ukraine had just become sort of briefly independent at that point, very, very short-lived. And there does seem to be a cycle, Simon and Anthony. I don't know if you see it like that, but that's certainly how it felt on the ground.
That's fascinating. So now I want to go back to the war itself. Those of you who know Russian history will know that, you know, the Russian Empire had conquered bit by bit many peoples. Lenin called it the prison of nations. Anthony, is it the right way to see the Russian Civil War partly as a reconquest of the Russian Empire?
Well, it certainly turned into that particular idea. What's interesting is the way that Putin criticized Lenin for the independence of Ukraine, which is absolute rubbish. What's interesting is the way that it was Lenin's attempt to avoid the idea of Russian chauvinism, that in the end of 1917, he gave the idea of self-determination. Now, the Ukrainians were far too weak to be able to take advantage of it, but the Finns grabbed the opportunity, and this is why Finland achieved its independence in its own civil war at the beginning of in the early part of 1918. So we see already this struggle between the former components of the Tsarist Empire and the nascent Soviet Union trying to grab back the elements of the old empire.
And of course Poland and Finland grabbed independence. The Baltics achieved it for a short time, and Georgia, Azerbaijan and Armenia lost it pretty quickly. But I'm just going to jump. I'm going to jump around a bit. We're not just going to do this chronologically. We all know who won the Russian Civil War. The Bolsheviks won it. Anthony, do you think if the Whites had won it, would there have been a fascist Russia at that time?
I think that's probably pretty likely. I mean, it's one of those sort of what-if questions of history. But I don't think the Whites ever really stood a chance of winning. They were such an incompatible alliance, a mixture of centrist, socialist revolutionaries, right socialist revolutionaries, but above all dominated by reactionary officers from the Tsarist army, and then the extreme anti-Semitic Cossacks right across Siberia and into the northern Caucasus and most of the Caucasus. And this was, as I say, an incompatible alliance who could never really get themselves together. But also because they occupied the periphery, really, of Russia, and the Reds, in fact, had the central area. And this gave them, in what is called in military terms, the advantages of internal communications, of that centralism gave them a huge bonus. But basically also, the Whites, and especially the Tsarist officers, were such obsessive imperialists that they irritated the Poles, the Finns, the Baltic states, all of whom could have supported them. But because of their imperialist obsession, they managed to exasperate them and, in fact, lose the opportunity of a sort of major anti-Bolshevik alliance.
We know what happened to the Tsar and his family during the Civil War. Was there ever any hope of a restoration or the use of the royal family as a banner?
Well, the interesting thing is, to what degree would the Tsar have represented a threat if they had lived? I think Lenin was determined, like many of the Bolsheviks, to make sure that the past was irrecoverable. That is one of the reasons why he supported the destruction of manor houses, of anything really to do with the past. It was, in a way, a cultural revolution as well as a political and a social one. But I don't think that the question was, which they were facing, was the Tsar and the imperial family more of a threat alive or seen as, if you like, as martyrs if they were dead? And I don't think that they had enough support. In 1917, one saw, to almost an astonishing degree, how few officers were prepared to fight or resist the revolution of February 1917, and even to a large degree, the October coup d'etat by the communists. So there was no real support.
So just in a nutshell, I know this is an incredibly challenging request, Anthony, are you ready for this? Just tell us, we know that Lenin, and assisted by Trotsky and Stalin, seized power in Petrograd. He moved the capital to Moscow. Then intervention and the raising of white armies launched the Civil War. Can you just tell us, in a nutshell, what the hell happened next? Because it's very complicated, but not too long. But just give us an idea of white armies coming in, being defeated, other ones coming in from other directions, and the interventions.
Well, the people talk about the intervention. I mean, there were so many different armies involved. One of the key armies, in a way, was a strange development, and it was that the Czechoslovaks, who had, of course, been divided between the warring powers of the First World War, between the Austro-Hungarian Empire, the Russians, and the Germans, wanted to come together. Sorry. Wanted to come together. So most of them crossed over the front lines to join up with their comrades on the Russian side. Trotsky made a huge, huge blunder because he threatened them when there was some trouble, and suddenly you have this Czechoslovak corps of troops who were well organized and well armed, and this created, in fact, what was the civil war right across Siberia. Without this particular clash, which Trotsky provoked unintentionally, there wouldn't necessarily have been much of a war in Siberia. The real battle really came from Denikin, General Denikin, a white general commanding in the south, and his troops, who were supported by the British, not with fighting troops, except for one RAF squadron, but above all was supported by a huge provision of guns, of uniforms, of ammunition, even hospitals, to help their their resistance to the Red Army, led at that particular point by Trotsky. This is 1918.
My grandfather was one of those soldiers in the intervention. But anyway, one thing I wanted to ask you, I'm going to come to you in a minute, Luke, but one thing I wanted to ask you, Anthony, was Trotsky, I mean, you mentioned a colossal blunder that, yes, Trotsky made. Was he the military genius of the Civil War? Did he deliver victory?
Well, Trotsky was a brilliant speaker. He could really raise the morale of the troops. And Trotsky would arrive in his armored train with even sort of, you know, special troops because he loved moving from crisis to crisis. But he was not necessarily a strategic genius. To start with, he opposed the idea of cavalry, which he thought was old-fashioned and aristocratic. But even then, he suddenly found that actually, because of the sheer landmass, the sheer size of Russia, to begin with, it was a railway war and a cavalry war. So eventually you find this wonderful, these posters, which the Red Army was putting up, saying, "Proletarians to horse." Then they realized that actually they had to reorganize the Red Army from an amateur basis onto a much more professional one. And Trotsky was very much behind that. This was opposed, of course, by Stalin, as Sebag would know any too well, and was in a way part of this original great hatred between the two men. But the real thing was that once they started to get their act together, the Reds were much more effective in the way that they would win over, even though they were often hated by the peasantry for the way that they were taking their food for the cities, they were still hated less than the whites.
There's a famous quote by Napoleon who said that generalship, like prostitution, is one of the professions where the professional is often less good than the amateur.
Absolutely. And also Napoleon also said, you know, do not interrupt the enemy when he's making a mistake.
Great, great one. Great one. There are amazing characters during this war, which we're going to come to in a minute. There are also some astonishing monsters, which we're also going to visit. I said already that Ukraine was the crucible of hell during this war, and much of that hell was, part of that hell was anti-Semitic pogroms going on with Ukrainian lead, under Ukrainian warlords. Before I come to Anthony to ask what actually happened, Luke, I'm going to come to you. You know, you're there now. The figures of Simon Petliura and Makhno and other leaders are very controversial in Ukraine now. Tell me a little bit about how people like Petliura is regarded in Ukraine, because this is an important part of the sort of political fight today.
I mean, Petliura was a Ukrainian nationalist leader who swept in to Kiev during this period, and actually, interestingly, I mean, we're talking about non-fiction books today, but when I was in Kiev last year, I was reading The White Guard by Mikhail Bulgakov, which is all about this, and it's full of kind of ironies, because he was Petliura's forces swept into Kiev in the same way that Russian tanks rolled in from the north and the northwest through these garden suburbs, pine forests, snow. It was the same direction. And certainly Bulgakov's view was that Petliura was an anti-Semite, was a nationalist, and was someone who represented these kind of dark, inchoate peasant forces who were tearing apart Kiev and bringing disorder and ruin. I mean, that was his view. I mean, I think this conversation is just very complicated, because on the one hand, I'd be interested to see what Anthony thinks about this, but Petliura, certainly his supporters were anti-Semitic. On the other hand, the idea that the Ukrainians are all Nazis, nationalists, anti-Semites is a kind of Soviet trope that Vladimir Putin and his propagandists have sort of instrumentalized to justify their invasion. I mean, I suppose the brief version is history is complicated.
That's right. I mean, that's why this book is very important to read and an essential reading today. So, Anthony, tell us what really happened with Petliura. You tell it very well in the book.
Well, Petliura,
who was he?
In December of 1917, 1918, the opportunity, if you like, for the Ukrainian nationalists was there to try to take over. And they didn't last very long because, they had very few troops, but there was chaos in Kiev at that particular time when they moved in. But then there was a whole, when I say an army, I mean, in fact, it only had about 2,000 men under Muraviev, who were the Reds moving in, and they pushed out the Ukrainian nationalists. So the Ukrainian nationalists had very little control over Kiev during that particular time. They were either pushed out by the Whites or pushed out by the Reds, and it didn't last for very long. But overall, it's been estimated that up to 150,000 Jews were killed during the course of the Civil War. But by both sides, in fact, you could say by all three sides, when you talk about the independent Ukrainian warlords like Grigoriev or Makhno
and so forth,
who were definitely anti-Semitic. Though Makhno did have quite a few Jews in his forces, there was no doubt about it. But I mean, these things were never simple. History is never tidy, I'm afraid.
That's right. I mean, I think an interesting thing, just to move on from Ukraine itself, is I would regard as a hero of the Russian Civil War, and there aren't many, is Pilsudski, Marshal
yes.
Pilsudski of Poland, who said, you know, an independent Poland is impossible without an independent Ukraine.
Yes.
Which is a very thing. Could you just explain to us, Anthony, how Poland stopped the Soviet invasion of Europe?
Well, the Battle of Warsaw, or the Battle of the Vistula, which took place in 1920, was all part of the Soviet-Polish War. I don't think the Poles would appreciate by saying it was part of the Russian Civil War necessarily, because as far as they were concerned, it was their greatest moment. And they feel that they saved Europe from international Bolshevism. There's no doubt about it. In 1920, the Poles were preparing themselves. They had advanced all the way to Kiev. They promised independence to the Ukrainians and to Petliura. Others suspected them of using that as almost as a cloak for taking over Ukraine. That was not. I don't think that's true, and I agree entirely with Seebag on that. But the key thing was that by this extraordinary, one of the great sort of tactical movements of history, the Polish army and above all the Polish cavalry managed to surprise the Reds as they thought they were about to conquer Warsaw and then move on into Germany and right across Europe. And the Red Army got a very bloody nose and in fact was forced into a humiliating retreat. Many of them had to actually flee into East Prussia and surrender their weapons. So it was, as many have decided or described, one of the decisive victories in the whole of history.
Yeah, because, I mean, Lenin was hoping to advance into Poland, and their real target was Germany.
Yes.
And, you know, Lenin's motto was, probe with bayonets. If you find mush, probe further. Yes. So that was one of the decisive battles of modern times. And the war was full of fascinating characters, which Anthony describes brilliantly. To jump far away from Ukraine and Europe altogether, let's go to the Far East, Anthony. And will you introduce us to one of the most diabolical lunatics ever to fight in battle, and describe the character and excesses of a man who thought that he was Genghis Khan reincarnated, Baron Roman von Ungern Sternberg.
I'm afraid that any civil war, but above all the Russian civil war, brings sociopaths, psychopaths, sadists of the worst order right to the top. And there's no doubt about it that Ungern Sternberg, who was a brilliant man in certain ways, you know, he was he had renounced, shall we say, all Western aspects. He'd gone, became a Buddhist, but it was at the same time prepared, you know, to inflict the most appalling cruelties in every direction. And he was not alone. I mean, there were other Cossack leaders who were equally as bad. And I'm afraid, you know, as I say, this sort of atmosphere gave an opportunity to leaders who basically should never have been let out of a cage.
But one of the fascinating things about the war is that though they failed, they lost Poland and Finland, and they failed to invade Western Europe, but they did get their first Soviet satellite in the Far East, Mongolia.
Yes.
How did that come about, Anthony?
Well, partly it came about because Ungern Sternberg and his lot basically thought that they could take over Mongolia, and I think that he had fantasies of being made almost the equivalent to sort of king of Mongolia or some sort of ruling figure. But in fact, this actually forced the Red Army and, if you like, the Presidium in Moscow to really make an effort of sending the whole of the Red Sixth Army into Mongolia so as to eliminate that. And this was, as Seebag says, you know, this was the first satellite state which they established. But one must also remember what was going on in the Far East, in the sense that the Japanese, who later took over what they call Manchukuo, but was Manchuria, in the 1930s, they already had ambitions in their idea of basically Lebensraum, of living room, of basically colonizing the Far East. And they basically had altogether at one point had actually sent as many as 80,000 troops into the Far East. And the reason why the Americans sent a division was to keep an eye on the Japanese, because the Americans realized, well, you know, Japan as the rising power was a distinct danger and threat. And this is something that we will see much later in the 1930s and then the Second World War.
the sequel to the Bolshevik victory in the Civil War was the creation of a new state structure, which is very relevant today. And before we get to questions, which are quite soon, let's just talk about how the Civil War ended and how Lenin and Stalin redesigned. We've already mentioned it a little bit about Putin blaming Lenin for giving Ukraine a sort of independent structure. Anthony, you do this very well in the book. It's quite complicated, but it's very important. How did Lenin and Stalin create the Soviet Union in 1922, the structure?
The structure, in a way, was much more one of trying to, if you like, unify the many different, when I say unify, should we say control the many different nationalities. And this is why Stalin, as a Georgian, was picked, if you like, as the commissar, the people's commissar for the nationalities. Stalin, of course, knew perfectly well that he was not interested in any sense of allowing a real independence of the nationalities. The whole point was to give an impressive overview of a unified Soviet state. I mean, what we have to realize when one's talking about Russia, and especially about Russians today, is one cannot generalize. I mean, there is no DNA to any country, and certainly not a country like Russia, which has so many different nationalities and so many different aspects. But what they were trying to do was to create, if you like, a Soviet unity. And this was the whole idea, rather as they had in 1917 when we were talking about the problem of self-determination. They basically wanted to integrate everything together, but of course under Soviet control, under Soviet leadership and command.
I mean, the idea was that it looked like they were independent states.
Exactly.
But a bit like the Hotel California, you know, you can check out anytime you like, but you can never leave.
Yes.
But then they did. So, Luke, I mean, just jump ahead now a century to what happened in 1991 when the states did become independent.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's interesting. You sort of look at why Russia has done this, and you look at Putin's, the invasion, I mean, of last year, Putin's sort of brooding obsession with Ukraine. And I do think swirling around is the sense that it was actually the Ukrainian Socialist Republic that dealt the death blow to the Soviet Union in 1991 by voting to break away and for independence, overwhelmingly, including, it has to be said, in Crimea, which voted for independence as well. And there's a sort of sense for Putin that this is unfinished business. And also, it's very interesting listening to kind of Anthony, that there's a real ideological incoherency about the history of now, about what Russia is doing now, because actually, you know, as Anthony was saying, this essay that Putin wrote in the summer of 1921, he explicitly blames Lenin for creating Ukraine, says it's a fiction, it was never a state, this is historical Russian land that he has to redeem. And at the same time, when I've been traveling around Ukraine, in areas occupied by Russia, where Lenin statues were toppled by kind of pro-European Ukrainians, pro-Western Ukrainians after 2014, after Putin's annexation of Crimea, Lenin has been going back up again. There's been a process of re-Leninization. So the villain becomes the hero. It's been very strange the way that the Putin regime appropriates, it's like sort of bricolage, different parts of Russian history, but has also very much been channeling the whole kind of white imperial legacy in recent years.
Stealing the body of Prince Potemkin.
And stealing the body of Prince Potemkin, most recently in the city of Kharkiv. Kherson, they took his bones across the Dnieper River. I don't know where Prince Potemkin is now.
Prince Potemkin is lost. But I think the point is that repeatedly in Russian history, the rulers from Peter the Great to Nicholas II to Lenin to Putin have believed that the Russian state cannot exist without Ukraine.
Yeah. I mean, definitely Ukraine is essential. And this is one thing I try and kind of look at in my book, in Invasion. I mean, Putin's reason for invading Ukraine is preposterous. He says he wants to denazify the country and demilitarize it. But I actually think that the greater threat, I mean, it's also a civilizational war as he sees it against the West, but it is really example. I mean, if Ukraine can be a successful, prosperous European country of 40 million people, full of Russian speakers, which is transparent and integrated with Western structures, then why can't Russia? Why can't Russia? And of course, he doesn't want that to happen, and therefore he has to crush Ukraine and to bring it back under his dominion.
Let me, we're going to come to questions now. If I forget to say at the end, Anthony Bieber, and as well as Luke and I, will all be signing copies of our books afterwards. And I cannot recommend Anthony Bieber's latest enough. It's essential reading, as is Luke's.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Jepper Bites. I'm your host, Laksh Datta. This podcast is produced by Launchora in association with Teamwork Arts. Please follow or subscribe to this show wherever you're listening to this to be notified about new episodes.